Good evening, everyone. Hi, it's great to see everybody here. My name is Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian who works with the Muslim Studies program. And I think, and this is our most recent iteration of the Muslim Journey series, but I think Salah Hassan was our first, maybe one of our first presenters, like several years ago.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. So he's back. Okay. We're really lucky. We're really lucky that he's back. He's an associate professor in the Department of English. Can you guys hear me? Well, okay. He's core faculty in our Muslim Studies program, who is, you know, the sponsor of this program, our Muslim Studies program. And he's also a faculty member in the Global Studies in the Arts and Humanities program. His areas of research and teaching include post-colonial literature and theory, mid-20th century anti-colonial intellectual movements, literatures of empire, Arab and Muslim North American studies. I'll just get to the end that he does research on a variety of topics. Maybe you'll have a chance to talk with him about that. He's a founder of a website called Muslim Subjects, there's a blog on there, and maybe most excitingly, I don't know, he's a producer of two films, and I've seen them both. Yeah. I like them both, Death of an Imam, and a recent one called Migrations of Islam, about Muslim American youth. So I highly recommend that one, and it's available in our library. So Salah's gonna give a lecture at the beginning, a kind of a short lecture, and then lead us in discussion of the book, and you have the questions there in front of you. So it's gonna be a treat to learn from him. Before we start, I just wanted to remind you of the upcoming events. So we're doing also a book club in February, reading Persepolis, and in March, reading The Butterfly Mosque. All those book club programs are gonna be here at this library. At one time, we thought the last one was gonna be at East Lansing Public Library, but it's not, because they're renovating, okay? So those are here. And then also in February, we're gonna be screening the feature animated film Persepolis. So after we discuss the book, the next week we're going to see the film, and that's gonna be located in Wells Hall. There's flyers for both of those events in the back. And should one more announcement before you start?
Yep.
Tomorrow?
Whatever you need.
Tomorrow, the Muslim Studies program and the GenSen, the Gender Center, have a teach-in called The Gendered Dimensions of the Ongoing ISIS-Related Conflict in the Middle East. So that's tomorrow, Thursday, January 21st, in the International Center, third floor International Center at 3 p.m. Okay? Thanks for bearing with me, and we're so happy to have Salah.
Okay. Thank you, Deborah, and thank you all for coming. I know it's early in the semester, and there's a basketball game tonight. So I really do appreciate you taking your time and coming to the library tonight. I really want to thank Deborah for organizing this whole series. She's been doing this, for a couple of years now, and it's been a great service to the university and very helpful to the Muslim Studies program. And she began this initiative with a grant that she obtained that allowed us to add to the collection, but also organize a series of events. And then she took the initiative after the grant period ended and pursued this and kind of made it a little bit of a kind of an ongoing event for the university and the broader community. So it's really, really great. Applaud her for that. And we're very lucky to have her here. So I have about 20 minutes, right? Is that what you said, about 20 minutes? Okay, so let me collect my, there was something else I wanted to say, but somehow when you were doing, do you have those questions? That's what I wanted.
Yes.
Yeah, do you have those questions? Because I don't have a copy of that. So you just give me those just for later. I don't need those right now, but I just wanted to make sure that I made sure I got those from you. Oh, is that it? Okay. Oh, okay, great. I started to write a paper because I've been wanting to write about this book. My colleague Najib Harani in anthropology and I have been collaborating on a couple of different projects related to Lebanon and the post-Civil War situation in Lebanon. He's far more of an expert on that than I am. He's sitting right there, so if you have any questions about Lebanon, you can ask him. He's also from the region that Anthony Shadid. My family is also from very close by. So we have familiarity with the stories that Anthony, we both knew Anthony. He's an old friend of mine. I knew him for a long time. And so he passed away a couple years ago, now 4 years ago, kind of in the border of Syria and Lebanon, trying to get back out of Syria when he's covering the civil war. And if you've read the book, you know he's had a couple of harrowing experiences covering the Middle East as the Washington Post journalist. And he was shot in Israel in the back by Israeli military. Quite serious injury, and then he was taken captive and held by the Libyan, by Gaddafi's army during the Libyan revolution, or whatever you want to call that, whatever happened in Libya at that time, right towards the end. He and three or four other American and European journalists were held and threatened, and you know, pretty horrible situation. They count of that by the people who were with him and his role in that, because he was one of the few American journalists in the Middle East who spoke Arabic fairly fluently and was able to communicate with people there in their language, and so was quite often in positions where he, you know, was able to negotiate his, you know, and his colleagues' release, and that's sort of what happened. I think he was able to sort of convince these guys who were thuggish in a lot of ways and wanting to kill them, but basically to not kill them. And I mean, it was such a transitional period. And then he was covering Syria, and he was with a group of people, including another journalist, and he was he had a asthma attack and basically suffocated because he partly related to his allergy to horses. There were horses in this kind of caravan, I guess, of people trying to flee Syria at that moment. And he was covering the war and also, I think, covering the exodus of people from Syria. And I think I think he was like trying to get it either into Lebanon or Turkey. Do you know if it was, I think it was like in that area, right? Syria borders on Lebanon, sort of in the east and, or on the west and south, and on Turkey in the north. And so quite a tragic situation, given all he had already been through, that he would, you know, under these circumstances, was unable to catch his breath, so to speak, and expired there in a kind of wasteland where a friend of his, who was a journalist, was trying to, you know, resuscitate him. And just to think about like what that must have been like for him and for his friend who were having to deal with that situation. So this book was published after his death. And many ways, he's written three books, I think, three books. He wrote, his first book was on political Islam and the emergence of a kind of Islamic militancy in the Arab world and more broadly in the Middle East. His second book was on Iraq. It's kind of a collection of essays that he published over the period of the Iraq War from 2003 to about 2006 or 2007. Some of the best coverage of the Iraq War was done by Anthony Shadid, not just because he was able to move beyond the embedded accounts of journalists, but also because of his just sensibility towards the culture. One of the most beautiful essays that he wrote is about this bookstore in Baghdad, one of the oldest independent bookstores in the Middle East. And the destruction of the bookstore and sort of his attachment to that place, Mutanabi Street in Baghdad. And it's a remarkable essay. You can find it online, but it's collected in there. So, I mean, he had this ability to, and if you've read any pages of this book, and hence the title of my my talk, Poetics of Place, you'll see that there's a kind of amazing relationship to language. Now, Anthony was like many of us. I mean, he was like just an ordinary guy. He grew up in Oklahoma and, you know, studied Arabic. He had to learn Arabic. It wasn't his native language. His parents were both born in the United States. And so he had to develop that relationship to the Arabic language. But in doing that, you can see that he also developed a remarkable relationship to English. And his writing is, it surpasses journalistic standards, I think, in a lot of ways. And I think you'll get a sense of that from some of the quotes I'm going to show you. So, of course, the center of the story is the town that his family, his ancestral hometown, Marjayun. Marjayun means, Ayun is the plural for springs. Ayn is I in Arabic. And Ayun is the plural for I. And the word I is also the word for spring, like where the water, like a water, a source of water. So it's like an interesting metaphor. And Marj means field or sometimes it's translated as meadow. So it's like this idea is really, it's poetic in itself. Unlike some of the other towns that have these, like my father's village is Balul. It's like Balul is just, whatever, nobody really knows what it means. You know, it's like these kind of strange town, village names that sort of sprung up in the mountains of Lebanon, right? It's like but Marjayun is like really this remarkably beautiful name and stands out, I think. And Marj itself as meadow or field has a lot of resonance. And Ayn in Arabic is also a term of endearment. So if you say to someone, like if you want to say my dear, you could say Ayni, which means my eye, like apple of my eye kind of idea. So it's got all of these layers of meaning. And Anthony is able to, in some ways, tap into that just by the various sort of ways that the word Marjayun, the name of the town, which is kind of a compound word, punctuates his prose. So what I've done in some cases, I've taken sentences, full sentences, and I've put them into poetic form to kind of show, like if you read them as poems. So here, this is just a kind of maybe a geographic place name description of Marjayun. He says, a gateway to Sidon on the Mediterranean and Damascus beyond Mount Hermon, to Jerusalem in historic Palestine, and to Baalbek, the site of the ancient Roman town, a place as cosmopolitan as a countryside offered. And so like in a way, like I read, like there's so many of these sentences, I'm just pulling some of them to kind of illustrate, but there's so many of these sentences that you can, if you punctuate them a little bit differently, if you put them into stanzas, if you look at them in terms of their rhythm, you begin to feel the poetic quality of his writing. And it doesn't take a lot of effort because he does the punctuation for you, as you can see here. He makes it possible for you, and you can almost feel the descriptiveness that he's trying to capture here is about place, so much about place, and this particular place, Marjayun, as a kind of crossroads within the Middle East. So here you have this town in the south of Lebanon, and I'll come back to this idea of the location of Marjayun and of the south of Lebanon in particular, in its connectedness to other parts. So the south is called like the Janoub. Janoub is the Arabic word for south. And I don't know if I've never used one of these before. How do I get it to turn on? Do I need to, where do you go? Anyway. Anybody know? Anyway, I have my arrow there. You don't need this. You can see I put an arrow in there. That shows you where Marjayun is, and you can see the blue area is the area that was the buffer zone between Israel and Lebanon. This is a zone that was also occupied by Israel, and many of these towns down here, Bin Jebel and particular were completely flattened in 2006 when I was in Lebanon in 2007. In the summer of 2007, in 2006, Israel launched a major military campaign against Lebanon. ostensibly to destroy Hezbollah, and but its tactics were aimed at really making the country unlivable. So things like bridges, main roads, power generating stations, water facilities, water purification facilities were all destroyed. So like it wasn't really aimed at the military operations of Hezbollah. It was aimed at the civilian infrastructure of Lebanon, and the air campaign was devastating in the south in particular, but also in Beirut and in the on the roads to Beirut. So making the parts of the country unlivable. And it was, you know, a lot of people left the country at that time. So one of the features of the narrative is that, you know, people, the exodus from the south. Because here you have this place, Majayoun, that's at the crossroads of, you know, Palestine, Syria, and on the roads to, you know, parts like northern Lebanon and then to the Mediterranean. And it's lower down in the mountains, and so it's kind of easier passage through the valley. And so you have like this beautiful place. And unlike a lot of the towns and villages around there, Majayoun, there'd be like three or four maybe that stood out. Like in my own personal history, like where my family's from is up, you can't really, they're not on here, but it would be like up here. It's not that far, maybe about 6 miles as the crow flies. Najib's family's from, it's not on here either, but is it a little bit maybe between Nabatieh and Marjayoun? Is that Dermi Mass is kind of in there? So right in here. A lot of people from Lansing, from that village, and they were also affected severely by the 2006 Israeli raid. And so when Shadid goes to Marjayoun in 2006, he's going there partly, he's covering the Israeli operation, and then he goes to his family village, and what he finds is that his ancestral home, the house itself, has been hit by a missile. And it's at that moment he begins, it sort of triggers this desire to restore the home. And then the project of restoring the home becomes a pretext, in a way, I suppose you could say, for a restoration of a different sort, a restoration of his own relationship to Lebanon, his own relationship to the town, to his family, and a negotiation of his relationship with a whole spectrum of other places and people, including his daughter from his first marriage, who is back in the United States, his relationship to people he knew in Iraq or in Palestine, and these kinds of things. So I just pulled this quote. Along the wadis, I passed the day I drove to Marjayoun. Empires had collided. And so there's this sort of contending idea about Marjayoun as this crossroads of civilization, so to speak, not civilizations in the plural, but of a kind of convergence of a common shared civilization, despite the differences of religion. So Christians, Muslims, Jews, pagans, others, who would have passed through Marjayoun at different times in the 2,000 years that he's sort of narrating through that place, and even longer. And I'll point to that, like the founding of Marjayoun. Like, how does that happen? How does that place come into being? Is an important story in the narrative. So on one hand, it's like this. It becomes a kind of microcosm for him thinking about civilization in the region, and a shared civilization across religious difference and across historical differences of time. And at the same time, it is a place of war. It's no doubt, it's like this place of war. It's a victim itself. It's a victim of the wars over the centuries. Vistas of Marjayoun. So Marjayoun is set on a plateau of muted and melded grays, browns and greens, blended in harmony with the land's past. So that line, like at first I was just going to quote that line because I really like the color, the idea of the colors, and what he's doing here with a different, like a kind of set of ideas that have to do with feeling and history, and how we feel history. How do we feel history? And there's something to that that he's able to capture, and very difficult to do it because like history can have such a kind of arid feel to it, as can geography. But he's able to bring this to life almost as a painting in a painting. From high points beyond Isper's house, so this is his, you know, the patriarchal ancestor. Isper's house, which is the house of stone that he's restoring, its surrounding can be surveyed. Beyond the town's entrance is the Hula Valley, in present-day Israel, where the finer families once kept prosperous estates. To the west of the town, over a ridge, the Latani River flows, its waters tucked beneath oaks, eucalyptus, and pines. On the other side are Mount Hermon and its peaks, which serve as borders of Israel and Syria. Beyond it are the Golan Heights and Kenetra, an almost abandoned city since its Israeli occupiers ravaged it as they withdrew in 1974. And we get a sense that, you know, the abandonment, the idea of abandonment, is that there's kind of been a depopulation of this part of Lebanon as a consequence of its situation on the border, but that it's populated by memories, nevertheless. And those memories, even in the abandoned house that is Isber's house, is what keeps it alive, in a sense, that keeps it makes possible the restoration. That if those memories aren't there, there can be no restoration. And so this idea, harmony with the lands past. So there's a kind of, and I just want to go back to that map, just so you can kind of get a sense of the geography that he's talking about. So the river, I don't know if you can see it here, this coming down through here. And then these areas down in here where he's referring to would be, you know, where that has now become part of Israel, but were formerly, so there was no border there historically. You know, if my mother, when she was a kid, she tells me she walked to Palestine, which would have been about 8 miles or something like, you know, maybe 12 kilometers or something like that. And I was really, she was like, yeah, my mother and I, we walked to Palestine to get textiles. They went to get embroidery and bring them back to their village. So this would have been in the 30s, early 30s, when she was a kid. So these borders that we see now, the borders that are the partitions of the old Ottoman Empire and now have, these are these borders of Israel and Syria, once were just these natural things that people had to contend with, the mountains and the valleys, the peaks, the rivers. But now what we have in their place are hard borders, borders that no one can cross, actually. It's very difficult to cross those borders. But there was a time when people could have homes on either side of the border and move between them. There's another interesting story where he talks about how, I just wanted to, a plateau of muted and melded grays, browns and greens. So this is kind of the vista that you can kind of see. So Marjayoun, it's, like I said, there was this concern with origins in the story, his own origins, his family's origins, but Marjayoun's origins, and there's a kind of weaving together of the origin story of where the town comes from. Why did people come there? How did they get there? And so one of the, and Anthony's very good. He's like he uses history, but he's also very much aware that it's in the telling of the story that things are, that history becomes myth. And so here's this account. He says, the myths of Marjayoun and its founding often revolve around accounts of perpetual flight, tales of war and exodus, told and retold over 18 centuries. They often make mention of a dam that once enriched a desert. So this is the dam. This fable of origin starts in the rugged climes of Yemen, in the land of the Queen of Sheba. It was here that the famed Ma'rib Dam channeled water to the parched landscape, but its occasional breaches also brought a near apocalyptic conflagration, that drove Marjayoun's ancestors to the rich fields of the Haran. That's where Najib's name comes from, the Haran. And so this is in Yemen. This is the dam itself. And there's an inscription here. And I don't know what the inscription says. Sorry, I didn't give my source there. But so this is, you know, an archaeological site now. But there's this kind of historical resonance of, like, Yemen is the source of old Arab culture, at least one of the sources, the South Arab cultures of Yemen. And they weren't nomadic people. They were sedentary people. They built dams. They built cities. And in contrast with, say, the Arabs of the of Northern Arabia, who were nomadic, Bedouin, non-sedentary people. And so quite often when people think of Arabs, they think of these northern Bedouin types, but there was also these others who were the southern Arabs. And so laying claim to that past as the past of Marjayoun is of a certain significance because it's a long history of being Arab. So Anthony, this is Muslim Journeys, Anthony's family was Christian. But there's a kind of pre-Islamic, pre-Christian, pre-monotheistic origin story that is at work in the formation of Marjayoun, something that not all Lebanese towns and villages can lay claim to, although maybe they do. I've never heard this story as part of, for example, we have a different one. The one that we have is a modern one. It's the modern of forced sedentary lifestyle where my father's family was forced into the villages for taxes. They were nomadic people from the Syrian desert who the Ottoman Empire sometime in the early 19th century forced into villages so that they could tax them and force them to cultivate, you know, stuff so they could. So this is the origin of my father's village, which is why there was no church there, there was no school there, there's nothing but, like, would have been stone houses built against the mountain. Like, the back wall of the mountain is the back of the house. So if you go and see the oldest houses in the village, they're just sort of piles of stones now, actually. So every village has these stories. We don't know what they are. But this one is a particularly powerful narrative of migration from South Arabia to South Lebanon. So this is the last quote I'm going to show you. So Isber Samarra's House of Stone. So this is of course, as Anthony works through his relationship with the village, the town, it's really, Marjayoun is more than a village. It would be more substantial than a village. You can like go on Google Maps and you can see sort of the expansiveness of it and compare it with some of the villages, and they're smaller. And he tells us that, you know, it was a place that had certain significance for the Ottoman Empire, that there was some officials there, that they used it for various purposes. And so when the Ottoman Empire ended, and it was around this time that the patriarch of the family was able to then, you know, make a deal for wheat or grain and get all this money and then build this house. But in the wake of the Ottoman defeat by the at the hands of the British and the French, particularly the British, there was a famine and disorder in the surrounding areas. And it's around this time and prior to this time that you get a lot of Arab migration from Lebanon and Palestine and Syria to the United States. So if you look at, if you ever go to the Arab American National Museum in Detroit, see, a lot of the immigration stories are from the period from about 1890 to about 1914. And that there's a couple of reasons. One of them is that initially the Ottoman Empire was recruiting Arabs, and so the militarization, and Anthony talks about this, is the recruitment of young Arab boys into the Ottoman army was a real incentive to send your kids off, you know, send the young men away so that they wouldn't be forced to fight in the Ottoman army. But in the wake of the war, there was, like, you know, hardship. And because the Ottoman Empire, whatever one would say about it is that it maintained a certain kind of order. And when that order collapsed, and the British and the French were negotiating their own colonial relationship with the region and sharing up the territory as the loot of World War I, there was pillaging and problems of distribution of food and resources, and so Anthony's ancestors suffered that. And so there's accounts of this in the narrative. And but it's also around that time that the house is built. So it's kind of like this, these two things happening. So he's just talking about like, no house in Marjayoun could lay claim to grandeur without the triple arcade woven together with the delicate wooden tracery brought in by the builders from the mountains. A debate over what had inspired the arch's design had long continued. Some suggested that the style came from the architecture of Venice, an influence born of a trade stretching back centuries. The arches were as much, a local innovation as cultures made influences their character. I had to read that. I don't know how many times that particular phrase, as cultures made influences their character. So I've cut out a little bit because it's a much longer quote where he talks about the trade between Venice and Southern Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean, Lebanon in particular, and Palestine. And there it's like the back and forth. So if you go to Lebanon now, you'll see that like wealthy Lebanese have gone back to their home villages and they'll take a piece of land and they'll build a big villa on this piece of land where they're, you know, next door to it is maybe the ancestral home that's sort of, they're like, you know, they don't want to like put a lot of money into restoring it. So they just go and they buy lots of stone and they build these things and they look like Italianate kind of architecture. And some people, you know, that's kind of it's like a way of showing your wealth, your prestige, and that kind of thing. And then you have other people who are restoring these older homes, trying to keep them, you know, alive in some fashion. And that's what Anthony does here. But the question is always like, you know, how much of this is you know, authentically Middle Eastern, and how much of it is like imported, and so there's this kind of back and forth that he's addressing there. And where he comes out is a kind of secular, I would say, a secular position on, and a non-nationalist position. He doesn't want to simply affirm that this is like about being Arab or Lebanese. He wants to allow for the possibility of absorption, that Arab culture is big enough to absorb what comes from outside without being threatened. Or there was a time, at least, when it was like that. And it's unfortunate if it can't respond like that now. But there was a time 100 years ago or more when, and so here's an image of the house and you can see the arches and that. He says, on the balcony which looked out at the world, the iron railings remained part of the house. And this is right in here. And I saved old cemento tiles and returned them to the house's entrance. Their array of shapes and colors made them three-dimensional. As I walked through it all, I had a sense of belonging, and I felt an affinity. And so these cemento tiles, this is really kind of a beautiful example of that similar kind of absorption of something coming from outside, but making it part of the culture so that the cemento tiles become necessary to the completion of the home at the time when Isber Samara built the house, that this was something that he had fixated on. He wanted this. He wanted this as a way of completing his house, is to have this decorative effect through these tiles that were imported. And they go hand in hand with the masonry done by the men from Lebanon who were noted for their work with stone and their ability and Abu Jan and his work on the interior of the house and the demolition and then rebuilding of the house. And all of these things that he sees as the kind of craft of making the home inhabitable again, and not necessarily returning it to its original form, but returning it in some way that makes it feel like it too belongs there again. So he belongs there, but what he's doing is also making the place belong like this place that's been abandoned now belongs. And it's a tribute, not just to his family, but a tribute to the town itself. That's kind of the way I see it.